China has 14 land neighbors. 12 of them, China has resolved the land, the disputes, territorial disputes through negotiations and dialogue, with only two exceptions, India and Bhutan. And for the maritime disputes, we can see that also China has been proposed since Ding Xiaoping that to shelve the disputes and to conduct the joint exploration. This doctrine had been there for decades. I think Xi still adhere to that. And also for the Taiwan issue, maybe one of the most dangerous and sensitive issues, peaceful reunification has never been changed, you know, at the basic or fundamental guideline for the cross-strait relations. I think we must keep that in mind when we talk about the foreign policy of China. And then third, continuity, I think, is China always hoped, since Deng Xiaoping tried to integrate into the international system, to take part in and play active role in those multilateral regimes like United Nations, IMF, WTO, G20, etc. And also, I think China still believe that and hope that given the increasing and irreversible tendency of the globalization, China need to stick to open up and policy and to enhance its national power. I think most recent speech given by Xi Jinping at the Boao Forum has given us a very good example. And I suggest all of you, if you are interested, you can read the whole document and the speech of President Xi Jinping. Later, I would like to discuss the changes. I think we have pay more attention to the changes, and because the change is always easier to attract attention. The first changes, I think, is China is true, becoming more and more proactive. If we use the two terms very with Chinese characteristic, Tao Guang Yang Hui, Yu So Zuo Wei, I would like to say, comparatively, China is more willingly to Yu So Zuo Wei, and less willingly to Tao Guang Yang Hui. But we must remember, since Deng Xiaoping proposed this document, this concept, as I think just now Professor Shenbo mentioned it clearly, that they are together. The two concepts is a unit, integrated unit. It's just all like the two sides of one coin. Deng Xiaoping's the origin quotation is, 中国无所作为不可能，必须有所作为。 Condition for that is Tao Guang Yang Hui. In English, while China needs to keep the low profile, it's impossible for China to now to attempt anything or accomplish anything. We must get something to be accomplished. That's the real quotation of Xi Jinping, of Deng Xiaoping, and what he really means. I think such a kind of spirit has been succeeded by different generations of China. And but comparatively, I think it's true. And I also admit that China is becoming less tolerant to the damage to its national interest, and more willingly to conduct stronger actions and impose higher costs on another actor than before. I admit it. Just like look what happened in East China Sea and South China Sea. China wants to send a signal that, hey guys, there is no free lunch. If you want to make some benefit or profit, you must be ready to take the cost. If you make your counterpart uncomfortable or unhappy. I think Beijing is sending such a signal clearer than before. But we also need to remember that China still seek to those former doctrines. For example, in South China Sea and East China Sea, China always adhere to and propose shelving the disputes and try to conduct joint exploration. And the reactions of China, I think, is kind of within limits. We can term it as assertive, but still far from aggressive. And for example, in concerning the Diaoyudao Island dispute, Senkaku Island, China is sending its more patrolling ships or surveillance ships to patrol around the Senkaku Island. And it's basically a kind of reaction to the nationalization process of Japanese No Doubt Administration. And for South China Sea issue, we should remember that the last, since the skirmish on the so-called Zhangsun South Reef, Beijijiao, between China and Vietnam in March 1988, China has never used force to solve any disputes with other countries for 30 years concerning South China Sea issues. That's the fact, and we also need to keep it in mind when we discuss the foreign policy of China. And the second change, I think, is China is paying more attention, more, please remember, what I want to discuss today is comparatively. China is paying more attention to its relations with peripheral countries, especially with the developing countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, instead of overwhelmingly emphasizing its relations with the developed countries, comparing with before. And China still thinks it's unregarded itself as the biggest developing country. And China now, I think, have a deeper and better understanding of the importance of a good neighborhood, as well friendly relations with the developing countries who have a lot of common interest with China. That's the second change. So we can see that the Belt and Road Initiative and also the massive investment of China in Africa and Latin America and so on and so forth. And the third change, I think, the China is more active to take part in regional and global governance. China has launched more new strategic initiatives, established new international regimes and institutions, and consequently provide more regional and global public goods than before. There are many reasons for that, because for example, in last year, 2017, there are more than 130 million Chinese go abroad for study, travel, and for business. And also we can see that the FDI from China is increasing in every corner of the world. And also we can see that one of the reasons for that is now China has more capability to provide those kinds of public goods. For example, to anti the terrorism, and also send the 20, I think since 2008, we have sent 29 fleets to go to the Somalia to fight against the piracy. And also China is very active to push and to implement the Paris Agreement concerning the climate change is something. And also I think Professor Sutter just now mentioned it's true. The United States is sending a lot of your soldiers and officials to fight and to in Africa to maintain the stability in that region. I admire that and I respected that very much. But I also want to mention one point is China is for at least one decade, China is the biggest supplier or providers of the peacekeeping forces of the United Nations for many decades. We are the number one. So we really have a lot of common interest. So generally speaking, I think we can see a lot of the continuity and consistencies, well, a lot of changes and transformation. But in my mind, I think, maybe I'm wrong, there are more tactical changes in China's foreign behaviors and concrete policies, but much less strategic changes in terms of China's guideline, doctrine, and strategic design for foreign policy. I would like to, I still have some time?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I think, you know, now I'm in the United States, and a lot of the American friends and Chinese students here, and I would like to say maybe a few words about the China-US relations, and also its global implications for us. And I should say, I have been here for more than half a year. I learned a lot of the discussions about China, about Beijing's intentions, capability buildings, and also its some, you know, evil, you know, visions of about his regional regime, hegemony ambitions, and something like that. But I should say that I think there are a lot of perceptions and misperceptions about China's intentions and especially intentions as well as capabilities. And China is changing. United States is changing. But China still, we agree and we believe that we are one of the biggest, the biggest developing countries. And the United States is the biggest and will be the biggest developed countries in the foreseeable future. Since the during Deng and Xi's governance, the world has witnessed, in terms of the structural power structure of the international system, has witnessed two big changes. One is the collapse of Soviet Union. Second is the rise of China. But there is one element or issue remaining there as a kind of constant. That is, U.S. is always the superpower in the world. I think Beijing have a very clear and keen understanding of that. So I think Beijing also knows or tries to avoid kind of misperception and misunderstanding between China and the United States. The second, the biggest and the second biggest economy in the world. Because those kind of misperceptions will lead to misinterpretation of intentions, and finally the political miscalculation, which will drive the two countries into confrontation and conflict. I think Beijing is trying to avoid it, but I think that we also need to, you know, the mutual effort from the two sides. If we look back into the history of China-US relations, I would like to, maybe very simply, you know, a kind of spectrum. You know, there are five types of the coexistence of China and the United States. Maybe to the far left is ally, like U.S.-China relations during the Second World War. We are allies. And to the far right, enemy. Maybe to some extent, the China-U.S. relations during the Korean War. Something like, looks like much like that, even though the two sides try to pretend they are not enemies. PLA use the name of the Volunteer Army, and U.S. use United Nations Army as a name, but actually we are fighting. But in the middle, there are three types. One is to the left, it's cooperative coexistence. And I think it's kind of like the, after 1972 until the end of the Cold War. And to the not so far left, right, it's kind of confrontational coexistence. It's like from the 1949 to 1972, the United and China relations. But where we are in now, I think in the middle, between cooperative coexistence pattern and confrontational coexistence pattern is competitive coexistence pattern. But why I think we need, it's very interesting that we have, you know, in the past 60
years.
Rather short period.
Intellectual property.
We have experienced almost all the five types of relations to none. I don't think it's very so good for us. And I hope that in the future we can avoid the bilateral relations to go downward from our now currently competitive coexistence to be dragged into confrontational coexistence pattern. And I think we need to, in the future, we need to enhance cooperation because we really have a lot of common interests. And that's, it is the common interest that brings us, the two countries, you know, to witness and experience so many ups and downs. But now, I think that we are still, you know, cooperate well, compete with each other. And so we need to do something, you know, to avoid the worst case scenario from happening and to control the risk, prevent the crisis. And I think it's not only in the interest of us, but also in the interest of the region and the whole world. Finally, I would like to finish my presentation by quoting a sentence by Secretary Hillary Clinton when she was still the secretary. She said that with China-US relations, we cannot solve all the problems. But without US-China cooperation, we can solve no problem. I think it's a very good judgment, and we hope that we can keep it always in mind when we think about US-China relations. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Nicely done.
We've heard a very clear outline of Chinese foreign policy history from Professor Sutter and Professor David Shengpo, and also a very insightful review of US-China relations from Professor Xin. And I only have one question to follow, mainly to Professor Xin. You are an expert of China's maritime security issue, and you mentioned that China has basically successfully resolved most land border disputes with its neighbors. So my question is, what's the biggest difference between solving a land border dispute and between solving a sea border dispute? And is China doing well in this respect? And if not, what's the biggest challenge that China is facing and how to improve that? Thank you.
Shall I?
Yes.
I think there are many elements contributed to the difficult situation now, comparing with the China's resolution of land border disputes. And first is, technically, first, the land border disputes between China, maybe including Russia, Kazakhstan, and Myanmar, and most of them, you know, it's kind of a desert, mountains, forest, you know, which you cannot see many people living there. And that means that those problems can be solved silently. And if the two sides have the willingness and they have the sincerely want to resolve those problems, the two sides, I think, can reach some compromise, and which both sides can accept. But for the maritime disputes, especially now we have Google, you know, the satellite, you know, it's very easy to identify and find out where the island is and who are living there, or whether there are ships and something like that. Technically, this is one problem that is very easy to, you know, arouse the publicity and the public attention to those very sensitive issues. And the second, I think, is that there is some interest concerns about that. And for example, if, you know,
land border areas, at least no news about whether they have some oil or natural gas, resources, something like that. But for the disputes involving Senkaku Island and also the Spratly Island, I think one of the key driving force is about the opportunity to explore the resources there. I think all of the countries are very concerned about that, and they want to take advantage of their positions by occupying and to control there and to explore the resources, which will be beneficial for their economic development for all the countries. And the second reason, I think the third reason is now I think there are, but China is becoming, as I mentioned, less, tolerant or more active to protect or to exert its claim. And because China is very disappointed, China has proposed that some kind of shelving the disputes and conduct the joint explorations. But in many decades, for example, in South China Sea, China haven't conduct or dig an oil rig there. But there are more than 1,000 oil fields has been explored, all by the neighboring countries. And China think that we have proposed those ideas and we displayed self-restraint, but it have not got the reciprocal reactions from our neighboring countries. So when there are some flashpoints broke out, then China will more willingly to react stronger than before. And it will, of course, will also cause the stronger reaction from the counterparts and make the situation worse and harder to have any opportunity to resolve that. But I think there are a lot of the reasons and elements to for the land border disputes and the maritime territory disputes resolution patterns. Yeah.
Thank you. Professor Chen and Professor Sabri, do you have any comments on this issue?
No way.
Not really, except I think it has to be mentioned something called PCA, Permanent Court of Arbitration ruling in The Hague in July of 2016 was quite clear about China's claims in the South China Sea. The PCA ruling 100% invalidated China's claims to the Nine Dash Line in the South China Sea. That's the only thing I would add.
Since now we have less than 20 minutes left, let's open up the floor to the audience and we will take questions by groups. So we will collect three questions all together and then we will let us answer these questions. This is the first one.
Okay, get ready for the journalists.
So thank you so much for the excellent presentation. I think my question is for Professor Shenbo. You mentioned in your book, The Chinese Future, that the U.S.-China relationship has entered a normal of intensified competition. So do you think this is going to, to which extent Washington is going to overhaul its China policy or its approach toward China? And also, if so, what would the new China policy look like? And do you think the current administration is actually adding uncertainty to this issue toward a U.S.-China relationship? Thank you.
Oh yeah, the second question from there.
Thanks. So my question is for the two Americans. I noticed that neither of you really have anything good to say about China, and you spent most of your time characterizing the CCP as dishonest and aggressive, and you consistently downplayed the accomplishments of the PRC, especially the One Belt Initiative, but I would like to point out that China has obviously, well, they've pulled about 500 million people out of poverty in the last three decades.